WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. Other than Winnie Mandela, there are few South African women who are known outside their country, even though there are many women playing key roles in the fight against apartheid. My guest, Diana Russell, has documented the stories of some of these women in her new book, Lives of Courage, Women for a New South Africa. Russell left South Africa in 1959 when she was 20 to attend college in England. She later came to the United States to do graduate work at Harvard. She now teaches sociology at Mills College in Oakland, California. Russell's brother David is a bishop at the Anglican Church. He also works closely with Bishop Desmond Tutu and was a close associate of Stephen Biko. Russell's father was a member of the South African Parliament for 18 years. Diana Russell has written several books on women that focus on sexual abuse, including The Politics of Rape, Rape in Marriage, Sexual Exploitation, and The Secret Trauma, Incest in the Lives of Girls and Women. Russell returned to her native South Africa for 4 months in 1987 to interview 60 women who've been fighting apartheid there. I asked her what drew her to write about the lives and experiences of women in South Africa.
Because they've been so badly neglected, a lot of people don't realize what an important part they play. Understandably, because they often are not in leadership positions. But what this book shows, what the story shows, is that women are playing a very important role on a grassroots level and in a sort of mid-leadership level and in the women's groups as well, doing very, very important work, as well as some in leadership positions. And I just wanted their voices to be heard for a change. I also had another agenda, and that was a hope that by doing this book, it might help the movement to take women more seriously. The struggle against apartheid is such a major focus that it's difficult to focus on sexism as well. And, of course, the men use that as well as an excuse not to. They say, you know, that's a distraction. And a lot of the women also feel that. So I hope that this book would just help to strengthen women's position in some small way as well.
You traveled to South Africa at the time when the South African government was being the most repressive within its country as well as on outsiders. What danger did you feel yourself in when you were conducting these interviews?
Well, the first one was whether I'd be allowed in the country at all. That was a great relief. And even when I got my visa, I was only sure that I would get to the airport because they said that I would then be checked by somebody. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But after I had been in the country 2 weeks, the security branch, the hated sort of security police, wanted to visit me. And I thought that they must have heard, as well they might, that I was going to do this project. I had written to tell a couple of friends about it, and the mail is examined on a haphazard, arbitrary basis, so you never know when a letter will be looked at or not. So I was, I was really afraid that the project would be stopped. When I went up country from Cape Town, where I started out, when I went traveled up by car, I was actually advised to call a friend every day back in Cape Town, and at a specific time, if I didn't call at that time, then that friend should call my lawyer and my lawyer would go search for me in prison. They thought, because that often happens, if I didn't have anybody to call, it often happens that you're just detained. They don't have to tell anybody that you're detained. There's no statement about where you are. So this is the way people just disappear. So I was told to sort of check the tire, get a tire gauge to check the pressure in my tires, because another common thing that's done is to blow your tires up so that you're likely to, you know, have a traffic accident. I was told not to carry a single note on me, you know, of a woman's name or address, to not have any evidence of what I was doing. And so it went on. I mean, this was rather difficult to do since I was taping the interviews. I was told to duplicate everything, send it out immediately. It was amazing because even though the security branch only tried to see me once, it was as if they were sitting with me all the time. And I never really knew, you know, when should I take a risk, when shouldn't I? In fact, you have to take a risk. Even though this was perfectly legal activity that I was doing, I mean, just interviewing women about what they're doing is perfectly legal. But in South Africa, the security branch can pick you up for whatever reason they want to. And I know somebody who interviewed just one of the women that I spoke to was thrown out of the country for doing so. So I never knew when the project would forcibly end. But miraculously, it didn't.
My guest is writer and scholar Diana Russell. Her new book is Lives of Courage, Women for a New South Africa. You quote Ruth Mompati of the African National Congress as saying, in South Africa, you don't decide to join politics. Politics decides to join you. I'm wondering, since you were born and raised in South Africa, what was the turning point in your life to make you decide to fight apartheid?
Well, I'm sorry to say, I had to leave the country. When I was 20, I left and spent 2 or 3 years in England and then returned. And even though I had become politicized before, I was still so caught up with sexism and feeling that, you know, politics was something that men do and not women do, that it didn't actually occur to me to join a political party. What I did was to hang out with men who joined, you know, the Liberal Party. When I came back, I joined myself and then participated in a nonviolent protest and very quickly came to see or believe that that was hopeless in this kind of a police state. So from that experience, also from reading some books and so on, banned books there, I became a revolutionary and decided to join an underground movement called the African Resistance Movement. When I was asked, you know, would I be willing, I just thought, since I don't believe nonviolent methods will work, I must be willing to go this far and join this group that sabotages government property. It was still very much at the first stage of revolution in the sense that it was not trying to do more than be violent in that kind of minimal fashion. Nevertheless, the risk was enormous, and I don't just mean for me, but because I remained a rather peripheral member since I then left the country to come to this country.
This was in 1963. Did you participate in any acts of sabotage yourself?
Well, I was a sort of a backup person in terms of one of the things I had to do was to solicit a surgeon to treat anybody who was hurt in the process of trying to bomb certain things. I had to sort of map out a terrain near a pylon. I had to have my home emptied of my parents and anybody else so that people could come after a bombing to change their clothes and escape. I did things like that. I didn't actually participate in any bombing, literally.
Mm-hmm. A number of the interviews in this book were very powerful and very moving and very painful to read because of what the women who had been in prison went through in terms of torture and the degradation. Could you describe your own sort of sense of these women and their ability to withstand the pain that went on when you were participating in an interview with them?
Well, you know, this is still quite difficult for me to understand because I think a revolutionary situation brings out the best and the worst in different people. And I was interviewing the people that it brought out the best in and the strength. I mean, because I just don't see, I'm sure it exists here, and I know, you know, there's been, you know, a lot of radical movement here. But nevertheless, in the movements I participated in here, I haven't seen that kind of courage. You know, your leg's broken, you are tortured in prison, and you want to commit suicide because it's so unbearable, and then you come out and you carry on, and thereby risking being picked up again. I mean, it's just phenomenal. But for me, one of the most powerful interviews was the first one in the book by Elaine Mohammed. I think because she was so articulate about how it felt to be a woman in prison. I mean, obviously all the other women were women in prison, but she was particularly good at portraying the sense of vulnerability she felt with being controlled by these men who she didn't know what they would do. Now, it so happened she was sexually harassed, but she never was actually raped in prison. But her fear of rape, it's a bit like I was describing, my fear of the security branch all the time I was there really, really affected me very deeply, you know, my dreams and nightmares as well, you know, in the same way, you know, her fears she talks about were there with her all the time. Fears, I mean, of course, men are afraid of being beaten up and are beaten up. But there's something, nevertheless, special for women about sexual violation. And she said herself that being just hit was not nearly as threatening to her as the kind of sexual innuendo that she got, like a security branch saying to her how much he liked interviewing women because he was able to get things out of them. And this really terrified her much more than being hit about.
How have these women, or say in particular this woman, coped with her life outside prison after going through this trauma?
Well, it took, I mean, that's another thing that comes across very powerfully is the trauma of then getting out of prison and readjusting. I think more than Elaine, a woman called Fasizwe Bukelani, who had been in for 6 years in solitary confinement a great deal, she was accused of terrorism, even though she maintains, and I believe her, that she was trying to help people escape from the country, not actually engaged in anything else. But at any rate, she got 6 years. When she got out, she, you know, everybody expected her to come and make speeches, and she just didn't know what was going on. She found the whole world different. She couldn't make decisions. She couldn't even decide how to spend her money. You know, she just was very, very traumatized, and it took quite a while for her to recover. And the same with Elaine. Elaine feels that, you know, several years later, she still hasn't fully recovered. When she came out of prison, there was friends came round to visit and so on. One of the things she had done when she was in prison, because it would be very, very hot, and she was in solitary confinement for 9 months, only for putting up a communist poster, but it was very hot, so she would take her clothes off and hang them up, because nobody could see her. When she came home and there was this gathering, she didn't even realize she was doing it. She took off her pants, hung them over the armchair, and wondered then why people were looking at her. She didn't, you know, she had just dissociated. I mean, she didn't know what she was doing. And she still finds herself, you know, difficult to concentrate and various things. But she's gone on. She struggled on, and she's, you know, both politically. She started getting involved then in anti-rape work because she was so affected by her fear of rape in prison. So she decided to work on that issue.
I was struck by the lack of support that the women in this book had from the men in their lives. Their fathers, the husbands, boyfriends, almost as if the women participated in their political activities on their own with no support in their lives except from other women.
Well, yes, I think that's true. Sometimes the husbands or lovers or so are in jail, like obviously Walter Sisulu, who's the husband of Albertina Sisulu, who is the co-president of the United Democratic Front, the biggest anti-apartheid organization. So in a sense, he can't be supportive. You know, he's in prison, and that was true for quite a few. But nevertheless, yes, that does come through, I think. Sometimes with the women, there are several stories where their husbands resisted their being politically active, and they basically had to get rid of those husbands in order to really be politically active. So you got what comes across as the obstacles, you know, for women to be political. Then, of course, the children are seen as their responsibility. Often, if their husbands are political, you know, he's off getting, you know, arrested and banned and imprisoned and whatever, which obviously is a big sacrifice. I don't want to belittle that. But then she's left to handle the consequences of her being political as well as dealing with the children and the kind of tearing feeling that gives her. Different women chose to handle that in different ways. You know, Shahada Issel, for example, really kind of educated her children from a very young age so that they were political too. In fact, one of her daughters, well, her only daughter, Layla, spoke at a gathering when she was only 7, and the police were already after her at 7, wanting to get her. She had to go into hiding at that age. Other women have tried protecting their children from their politics and not telling them what they are doing. Nevertheless, if they detained, for many of them, I mean, Winnie Mandela describes the excruciating pain of having her children torn away from her as she's being hauled off to prison with nobody to look after them. That is one of the struggles that I hope to convey, because it's just very different for a woman often trying to be political.
You were talking earlier about Walter Sisulu. Hasn't he been released from prison?
Yes, he has. Just last year, in 1989, he was released. And so now everybody's waiting for the final one, Nelson Mandela, to be released. And Winnie Mandela made a statement just last week saying that she really believes he's going to be released very soon.
Mm-hmm. One of the women that you interviewed for your book is Winnie Mandela. And in 1988, 1989, there were the reports of her involvement in the beatings of some young anti-apartheid, young 14-year-olds with her guards. And you preface your interview by saying that these allegations have come up, and you want to explain it in terms of the pressure that she has been under. And I wonder if you can explain what you saw going on in her life.
Yes, but first of all, I should say, you know, we really don't know fully what did happen, and all the more so since nothing has emerged since then. It's all very mysterious why the white South African government hasn't tried to make something of this. Do you know what I mean?
No, the whole story seemed to have disappeared.
It does. A couple of her bodyguards were prosecuted, and definitely in prison. I think they might have been hanged, because of course South Africa is one of the biggest hanging countries in the world for killing the doctor who testified that one of these young men, Stompie, or boys, I should say, 14-year-olds, a boy, was in very, very bad shape, and he was murdered, and two people among the bodyguards were prosecuted for that, but nothing has happened with Winnie, and it seems like it's all over. So it remains very mysterious, but what I say in the book is, if something like that did happen, we have to understand that people are affected by extreme oppression. I mean, as I said, you know, the revolutions bring out the best and the worst, but, you know, nobody can be expected to remain a saint or even just an ordinary human being necessarily if you are put through a sort of concentration camp experience. I mean, we saw with the concentration camps what happened to some people who actually imitated SS guards and so on, according to Bruno Bettelheim, who was there himself. People break down. Battered women break down when they are, you know, submitted to torture day after day after day, and they become different people. She described how hardened she had become in the interview, that, you know, because I kept trying to get her to talk about her feelings, and even though she does show a lot of feelings, she one of her responses was, well, you know, when you just kind of get one thing after the other, after the other, after the other, I mean, your emotions get blunted. So I don't know what happened, but what I don't appreciate is when people think that it's, you know, so extraordinary if somebody does break down and behave in a terrible way. You know, it's like, I found actually a lot of people just refuse to believe anything like that is possible because they have reified her so much. But she is a human being, a remarkable human being. But nevertheless, everybody has their breaking point.
My guest is Diana Russell. Her new book, Lives of Courage, features interviews with women in South Africa. Your brother is a bishop in the Anglican Church of South Africa and was a close associate of Stephen Biko's. He was under house arrest for five years.
5 years is the usual length of time to start with. Often it's then renewed, you know, to another five-year period and so on. And he's also been in prison a few times as well. Not so long ago, he held a commemoration service for the death or murder of Steve Biko, and police came into the church with their guns and tried to stop him. And he sort of stopped the service and refused to, he said he refused to give communion as long as there were guns in the church. So in the end, actually, they put them down and took communion.
But that sounds very bizarre.
It does, doesn't it? Well, it does indeed. But actually, South Africans, black and white, are very religious people. And I guess they were affected by, they were told to do this, and they got talked out of it.
You once felt that the whites of South Africa were unconvertible to an anti-apartheid view. They had too much to lose. But you also think that perhaps the behavior of the white regime in South Africa is just the kick of a dying horse. I wonder what your prognosis is.
Well, I think that, you know, people change when they are forced to. And what I couldn't see in the past was how can the white South African government be forced to. I think that a revolution has been necessary. I mean, I mean by that the African National Congress has resorted to armed struggle. And I think that without that threat, I think that nonviolent methods could never have gotten the government to this point. But whether this particular regime will be willing to really, really change and give up their monopoly of power, I very much doubt it. I very much doubt it. Unless the international community, combined with, you know, combined with the internal struggle, kind of force them to be. They could be forced to give it up, definitely. I mean, that's what many women said, too, is like, the international community wanted South Africa to change now, that could happen.
I want to thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us today on Fresh Air.
It's been a pleasure.
Diana Russell's book, Lives of Courage, Women for a New South Africa, is published by Basic Books. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.